Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Haudenosaunee and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Earth Matters has been broadcasting on radio and podcasting for 2 years now, over 100 shows. I've met and chatted with leading experts studying complex issues and regular folks just trying to make a difference in their daily lives. Guests have come from England, Germany, Uganda, Kenya, New Zealand, Australia, all over the United States, and of course, Canada, where I'm from. Why am I saying all this? It's because Earth Matters, the podcast and radio show, is coming to a close. It's been a joy to discuss various different solutions to environmental problems, and while my subjects have been diverse and wide-ranging, I still feel I've only scratched the surface, which is a good thing. It means there is a lot more out there. As I say in the intro, Earth Matters sought out solutions, reported on news and events, and hopefully inspired listeners to preserve and protect our planet. So, to wrap things up, I've compiled a series of short clips from previous shows, in no particular order, to show that others are taking positive steps and that there is much more to come, if we can all focus on what's important for the natural world around us. Good luck, and thanks for listening. M-Copa Solar has provided 750,000 homes in East African villages and towns with small, affordable solar kits, bringing households light, power, and communications, and avoiding harmful kerosene and diesel fumes. Through micropayments, as little as 50 cents a day, M-Copa allows customers an affordable approach to ownership and self-sufficiency. Since 2010, co-founders Jesse Moore and Nick Hughes and their growing company have employed 3,000 people and avoided approximately 780,000 tons of CO2.
The honest truth is the environmental impact is the cherry on top, which isn't to say that I am, you know, the company aren't deeply motivated by environmental impact, but it doesn't begin from a customer proposition, let's say, which is you can help climate. That is a corollary to the main point, which is you don't, as a customer, you want a modern electricity connection and you're sick and tired of burning kerosene every day, right? And I say that carefully, but I think it's a really important point. You know, a low-income person may have as much or more to gain or lose from climate change than anybody else, but I would find it difficult to ask that person who's probably choosing between, you know, school fees for their kids and medical bills for their grandmother and food on the table, you know, to spend more money on their energy. That won't work, right? That's not fair. They can't manage. So in our case, we have really tried to just make energy more affordable. And our competition isn't the grid. It is off-grid products. And principally that comes into the nasty product of kerosene, as in what goes into jet fuel. That fuel is the principal way that East Africans will light their homes at night. It may look at first glance quite romantic to the Canadians when you think of going to the cottage and having a fireside sort of light and camp lights or whatever. But if you're dealing with that day in, day out, the fumes, the cost, the health impacts and the danger of kerosene are really, really terrible. And so people are looking to get off of that. Why they don't have the grid is because the grid doesn't reach them. The grid is too expensive. The grid is, you know, for a number of reasons, just not there yet or may not never get there. And so our proposition became, how can we give people the opportunity to get on a solar system that is standalone, doesn't need the grid, can power off a panel on the roof, can charge up a battery, and that battery can discharge into lighting and other basic home appliances, kind of like Powerwall, if you know that proposition from Tesla. We've been doing that for years, and we've done that 750,000 times, which is to say, give these homes a standalone power solution, which works for them off the grid and saves them kerosene from their daily lives.
Rotary is a global network of 1.2 million business people in 35,000 chapters dedicated to service above self. Rotary's people of action have used their passion, energy, and intelligence to take action on sustainable projects. From literacy and peace to water and health, they are always working to better our world. The Environment Sustainable Rotary Action Group, SRAG, was formed to empower members of the Rotary family worldwide to take actions to sustain our environment, particularly to stabilize our climate. Karen Kendrick Hands is one of the founding members of SRAG and its past chair.
A relatively new member of my Rotary Club, I realized that given the quality of humanitarian organization Rotary is, that it might have a role in helping the world find climate change solutions. So I went searching on the web to see where the environmentalists were and where the environmental programs were within the Rotary world of 1.2 million members and 35,000 clubs. And I didn't find very much. I went to a district conference, raised my concerns, met the past president of the Rotary Club of Madison, Paul Riemann, and he and I began to work together to see what kind of space within Rotary we could create for environmental concerns generally, but specifically climate change. A lot of times Rotary leads and the governments catch up. When I was in Buenos Aires, the concierge at our hotel was trying to help me find a Rotary club to it. And Rotarians are supposed to attend a meeting every week. And I was looking for one in Buenos Aires. And the concierge spent quite a bit of time. He said, where I live at the outskirts, we have roads and we have water and we have sanitation because the Rotary clubs helped us with that. So in that part of the world, the Rotary clubs were ahead of their governments.
Today's question is, with the dominance of capitalism all around us and the focus on GDP as the only measure of success, can we find a way to interact, exchange, and benefit from our labor without destroying the planet in the process?
And Shareable is a nonprofit media outlet and an action network that empowers people to share for a more resilient, equitable, and joyful world. And that joy part was really important for us because we felt like there's so much enjoyment that comes from sharing.
That's Tom Llewellyn, Director of Strategic Partnerships with Shareable, a nonprofit media outlet that highlights the sharing economy, collaborative consumption, cooperatives, and the commons.
Shareable has been around since 2009, and we kind of came together to spread the untold stories or undertold stories of sharing. And initially, the idea was to try and start a kind of global sharing movement. But very soon, we realized there was already a movement underway. It just didn't get a lot of press. And so we kind of wanted to focus in on the media aspect to begin with, and Shareable is a nonprofit media outlet and an action network that empowers people to share for a more resilient, equitable, and joyful world. And that joy part was really important for us because we felt like there's so much enjoyment that comes from sharing and collaboration. And so we did want to start with that storytelling part, and we've got this weekly magazine where we produce about, I don't know, 4 to 8 stories per week about sharing. And but then that community organizing part, bringing people together in physical space to share resources, to collaborate on events, and to try and network the various projects in their communities was really important to us. So we started what we refer to as the Sharing Cities Network in 2013. And that was there to kind of complement our third program, which was our policy work. And in 2011, we hosted the first conference on sharing cities in San Francisco called ShareSF. And that kind of started to launch a global movement of sharing cities, which now there's about over 50 cities that have an official sharing cities program worked into the city government. So our work is really focused on that media and storytelling, the community organizing, and we work with groups to start over 50 sharing initiatives, providing seed funding for those and advising for a lot more, and then also the policy work and pushing sharing cities.
Speaking with Jen Baker, Land Trust Manager with the Hamilton Naturalist Club. Jen, thank you very much for talking to us on Earth Matters.
So a land trust is an organization that works to permanently protect land. So it's a non-governmental organization that just wants to make sure that land is protected forever, just for the sake of protecting it. There are a number of things. So we have like a list of criteria. And generally, it's how under threat is the property? You know, is it going to be protected even if we don't acquire it? Is it in an area that we have an interest in? So are our members already visiting the area? And, you know, is there reasons that people would want to go there? The ecological significance of the area. And a big factor also is, can we maintain it? So can we, with volunteer power, actually manage the land and take care of the land? Because when we take on a property, we're taking it on forever. So we want to make sure that we can actually have the resources that we need to properly take care of it. So if they're donating, so as you said, they get, I guess, just the feel-good feeling of making sure that the land that they love is protected forever, but they also get tax benefits. So, you know, there's no capital gains tax from the donation. So you get a tax receipt for the full appraised value of the land, and you can use that tax receipt over 10 years. So that's a pretty good benefit to landowners. There's also things you can work in, like if they live adjacent to the land or something, you can work out arrangements that maybe they can still visit the land for sure. But if they've always taken wood for their fireplace from the land, you can work out those kind of arrangements as well. But I think the tax receipt is probably the biggest tangible benefit.
Scientists and foodies have been searching for alternatives to traditional animal protein-based food. Land use, greenhouse gas emissions, and obesity are touched on during this discussion about eating insects instead of beef, pork, and poultry. While many may get squeamish at the idea, entomophagy, people eating insects, is a possible way to ensure a sustainable and secure food supply for the 8 billion of us on the planet. David Waltner Taze, a veterinary epidemiologist from Kitchener, Ontario, releases his latest book, Eat the Beetles.
Insects in general tend to fall into where fish and chicken would be. So high protein, tend to be low fat. But there's variation. One of the things that struck me when I started looking at insects was there are millions of species. There are more species of insects than there are of any other kind of animal on the planet. There are more species of beetle, which is one part of insects, than there are of, like there's 15,000 species of mammals, but there's 360,000 species of beetles, more or less. People, there are new ones being added. So there's a lot of variation. Some of them are high in iron or zinc. Most of them don't have high saturated fats, but there are a few like palm weevil larvae and termites that do have high saturated fats, which is fine if you're in sub-Saharan Africa and you need a good fat source as well as a protein source. In North America, we certainly don't need, you know, more fat content in our food. So there's a lot of variation. And the ones that have been picked up in North America for eating have mealworms, which are actually larvae of darkling beetles, which are beetles. There's a whole range of different beetles that feed on detritus on floors and things like that, forest floor, or in they actually feed on. There are certain species that feed on the stuff that they put on the flooring in chicken barns. So they can be a pest in chicken barns. But there are other species. They take the larvae and then they cook them up. They roast them, and they can either grind them up or you can have them straight up. Fried with a bit of, you know, chilies and things like that.
Juno Award winner Sarah Harmer combines her music career with her passion for the environment. Can the two be compatible? Sarah talks about her love for the Niagara Escarpment, a UNESCO biosphere reserve, and what prompted her activism to protect biodiversity in the area. Harmer produced an album of music dedicated to the escarpment titled I Am a Mountain.
It's really I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of timing and what you can focus on, but other times it just gets its hooks into you, you know, and you start to learn about an issue that it seems, government officials, Ministry of Natural Resources or Environment should be taken care of. And you start to, as you learn more about some of these issues, you start to realize, well, the Endangered Species Act isn't really being upheld here. And you get, it kind of gets its hooks into you, you know, it's kind of like a soap opera. As soon as you start paying attention, you're into it. And obviously, the living world, issues of endangered species have really been on my radar for a while. And it's easy to speak up for Blanding's turtles and Jefferson salamanders and those amazing creatures that aren't that don't have a publicist and that are dwindling. We're doing a terrible job in Ontario of actually enforcing our Endangered Species Act. There's huge loopholes in it, and industry has lobbied really hard and been successful. And so to see something that ostensibly is protected actually not having the real protections that should be in place, I guess that just kind of gets me focused but it isn't a grand plan. I'm just sitting here at my kitchen table sending letters to the editor and maybe presenting at the local county meeting and trying to get our elected officials to use the power that they have to exercise some jurisdiction over areas. And yeah, in Kingston, I've been focused on an area just north of us here called Johnston Point, which is, if you can develop Johnston Point, nowhere is safe as far as I can tell. It's got at least 5 endangered and threatened species. And, you know, the developer did a terrible job when they did their first investigation. They didn't find anything. So they went to an Ontario Municipal Board hearing saying that the place was, not really ecologically valuable. And then, of course, citizens raised money to get a peer review done. And sure enough, there's loads of threatened and endangered species. And so just trying to enforce laws that are in place. But industry lobbies really hard to create loopholes, and so that there's exemptions made constantly, and I don't think that's right.
Suburban Remix brings together experts in planning, urban design, real estate development, and urban policy to demonstrate how suburbs can use growing demand for urban living to renew their appeal as places to live, work, play, and invest. The case studies and analysis show how compact new urban places are already being created in suburbs to produce health, economic, and environmental benefits, and contribute to solving a growing equity crisis. Authors, editors Jason Besky and David Dixon discuss their latest book.
One of the things that has most fascinated me, one of the authors in this book is a woman by the name of Lori Volk. Well, she and her husband, Todd Zimmerman, I should say together, and their son, wrote a chapter on what's happened to American housing markets. And housing represents two-thirds of real estate investment in this country, and it really shapes real estate markets and shapes how we develop as a society. And long story short, one of the things that Lori has reported is if you interviewed anybody in the housing market 20 years ago even and asked them what mattered most, it would be things that were about the individual household. This is everybody in the housing market: a big backyard, distance from work, a wonderful house, you know, lots of room, things like that. If you take the same, not the same folks, but their counterparts in 2018, and you sit them down at a focus group, you ask people what they really want. Oh, and golf courses were really big. Okay, golf courses are not in the same top 10. Backyards are not in the top 10. What people ask for most is a walkable main street nearby, a walkable main street that they can walk to, a short commute to work, places that bring them together as a community. And that sort of profound change has a whole lot to do with what actually is a generation of profound opportunity for suburbs. When Jason and I started to talk about this book, which was about 5 years ago, there was a lot of talk about the end of suburbs and we've reached peak suburb and things like that. And what people actually were talking about is, I think, the end of sprawl, and we've reached peak sprawl. Because the great opportunity that suburbs have discovered in the last really 10 years, but particularly the last 5 years, and more so going forward, is their ability to grow in and up, not out, to create great urban walkable downtowns, main streets, the things that people want today, just as they created what people wanted 20, 30, 40, and 50 years ago.
Plug and Drive is a nonprofit organization committed to accelerating the adoption of electric vehicles in order to maximize their environmental and economic benefits. Since 2011, Plug and Drive has established itself as a leader in the electric vehicle industry, a trusted and unbiased source of information on electric cars, charging stations, and the electricity sector. Kara Clareman is the president and CEO of Plug and Drive. Earth Matters caught up with Kara as she was speaking at an event hosted by the McMaster Center for Climate Change. The McMaster Center for Climate Change is a multidisciplinary program working on climate change research at McMaster University with international collaboration.
So one of the biggest barriers we're finding is really price. People believe EVs to be too expensive, and although they are a bit more expensive, so there's truth to that, they are a bit more expensive to the equivalent gas car, but the total cost of ownership, you know, your annual cost on fuel and maintenance is much, much lower in electric cars. So if you did the math 5 to 6 years out, you'd see even at today's prices, there's a good business case for an electric car. But what our challenge is try to persuade people to pay now to save later. Mm-hmm. Always a challenge.
And the savings on the gas and the maintenance, that's a benefit as well?
It's a significant benefit. So you're going to save on average about $2,000 a year. And so even if the vehicle is $5,000-$6,000 more than an equivalent gas car, I mean, you've made that back in 3 years or so. So really, in my view, there is a good case for it now, but we have to help people understand that.
How critical is the range anxiety? That seemed to be the thing that everybody was talking about 5, 6 years ago.
True. I think range anxiety was a bigger thing when EVs first came out. well, those vehicles had shorter range and there was very little public infrastructure out there. Now things have changed quite a bit. You've got a lot of brands of vehicle available with 400 plus kilometers of range. And then you also have an explosion of public infrastructure. So although range anxiety is still a bit of a concern people have, it's not nearly as much as it used to be. And I saw a funny comment recently that the best thing to do to get rid of range anxiety is to buy an electric car, because as soon as you have the car, you realize you really never needed to have that range anxiety.
Because most people drive 40, 50 kilometers.
Exactly. Most of us are driving a short haul. We just go home, we plug in, and we never really have to worry about it.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates that by 2050, up to 250 million people will be displaced by climate change impacts, such as rising sea levels, floods, famine, drought, hurricanes, desertification, and the negative impacts on ecosystems. Amalia Tower is the founder and executive director of Climate Refugees. Amali has worked in the past 12 years to promote the protection of refugees and forcibly displaced persons in a variety of contexts, including refugee settlement, protection, evaluation, and research.
We don't have any data that determines how many people might be displaced or affected by climate change. And there are several reasons for this. Most importantly is that the climate change is not one of the factors that is considered by international law to render someone a refugee. So let me just kind of begin by, let's talk about terminology is important, but that also is a great stepping point to, or stepping stone to understanding why we're in this dilemma. It's important to understand that refugees are those who have a well-founded fear, who have crossed the national borders of their own country into another, and are fleeing for reasons of race, religion, or persecution rather, on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. You'll note that climate change is not amongst those reasons or grounds for persecution that are protected by international law, and very specifically by the Refugee Convention. So that oven by itself helps you understand why I can't really tell you what the plight of climate refugees are, because we don't know. We don't have data that's tracking to determine are people fleeing for reasons of climate change. And then if they are fleeing or migrating or being displaced, because there are various terms being used here, not only are we not tracking that, B, they wouldn't be protected under international law, and C, they may be moving, but within borders of their own countries, which is by and large that what the limited data is showing. And also as far as scoping the volume of this potential problem, experts contend that most likely people are going to migrate or be displaced. And when you talk about migration, it's important to understand that migration can be voluntary as well as forcible. And so when you talk about migration or displacement on the basis of climate change, it's important really, whichever term you use, to understand, is there a forcible element of why people are moving? I.e., does climate change pose an external threat to their lives and therefore they have no choice but to move? And if the answer to that is yes, then we as an international community need to recognize that maybe there's an element of protection that we owe people who are impacted by a global phenomena that they've had no role in playing.
As I say in the intro, Earth Matters sought out solutions, reported on news and events, and hopefully inspired listeners to preserve and protect our planet. Good luck. And thanks for listening.